Donald Trump is president-elect of the United States of America. The German government imploded. And I don't want to talk about any of these things, to be honest. My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Balder Hagritz, and we are back with the Western Bubble podcast. Balder, how are you feeling after such an eventful week?
Hi, Dario. Well, compared to you, I think I feel fine. And this is something that we are going to discuss today exactly because of that, right? We see that your generation finds it particularly hard to deal with, for example, the Trump election. You specifically told me on Wednesday, I don't want to talk about Trump in the podcast. And I think what you notice is that at least older people, including myself, are not necessarily happy about these results, are not happy about events in general in the world, but we are not as emotionally connected to it as your generation. And I think that's something worth discussing today.
I'm not sure whether it is particularly my generation or whether it is also a little bit the zeitgeist, right? Just the mood of our times, that we are living in our little protective bubbles and anything uncomfortable we can just, you know, skip or, I don't know, ignore. So I think it might be also just the zeitgeist that is fostered by our surroundings.
It is. That's very true. It's not, I don't want to simplify it into black and white, as if anyone above 40 or 45 has no problems with it or is not emotionally connected to it, and vice versa. Of course, there might be 18-year-olds or 20-year-olds who are perfectly okay analyzing the situation. So you're absolutely right in that sense. But the zeitgeist is in many ways most visible in younger generations, right? Because younger generations are kind of the vanguard of the zeitgeist. They're pushing the world into a different direction, into a different place where we perceive things to be either good or evil. We perceive things to be some kind of sacred fight rather than feeling okay with a world that is imperfect.
But how are you feeling about these results? Because last week, the episode was very much me being a little bit excited, right, about a US election is taking place. I get to stay up all night, eat candy, drink energy, well, Coca-Cola type of stuff. I get to, I don't know, watch it. I was expecting a little bit more a Harris win over a Trump win. And then throughout the night, right, my mood shifted and it kind of went down, right? Maybe I was also tired, but the realization at some point kind of hit me that, we're going to see 4 more years of Donald Trump as the president of the United States. And that is a different, at least for me, it was a different feeling than 8 years ago when it happened for the first time.
Yeah, and it's interesting. So for me, it was also a different feeling than 8 years ago, but exactly the reverse. So 8 years ago in 2016, I remember that I was exactly going through this process. I started the night relatively optimistic about Hillary Clinton winning. And by 2 or 3 o'clock European time, it became clear that dark clouds were gathering and Trump might win. And that morning, I remember I had to give a lecture at university and I was in the foulest mood I've ever been in. I was really, really in a dark, dark place that morning. So in that sense, I know what you're feeling, especially if you have a little bit of excitement thinking that your person is going to win, your candidate is going to win. But even 8 years ago, I was still capable and even happy to spend a whole session of my lecture, that's almost an hour and a half, talking about the elections, talking about Trump. And I think that's where a difference comes in with today's world, where people just basically on Wednesday morning said, I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to have anything to do with it. That's where there is this generational, or if you like, this zeitgeist gap.
Well, just to make that point, right, for me, it was not so much about my candidate winning, because I didn't really have a candidate. It was more about one candidate not winning. And I mean, it's interesting, right? Because I feel like the rational thing to feel now is actually worse than 8 years ago, because the circumstances are completely different, right? Because 8 years ago, we kind of had that feeling or security that, okay, you know, Trump is going to pick a team and you know, there's also bureaucrats involved, and kind of the system will keep him in check, right? The generals and the military will kind of will prevent him from doing anything rash and stupid. And there will be advisors, right? He has to pick advisors with experience because he doesn't have any. So it will all be more or less fine, right? And we saw some of that, right? I mean, he always said he wants to leave NATO. After 2 minutes with the generals, he very quickly changed his mind. This time, it's the complete opposite, right? Because everyone who was part of his team eight years ago basically came out saying he's dangerous and he's bad for cover for the government. He cannot be in power again. And so those people are gone, and the options that he could choose are becoming fewer and fewer and scarier and scarier. So I feel like the rational thing to do or to feel when looking at this is, oh, this is a lot worse than 8 years ago.
Yeah, that is a valid analysis, I think. I don't have a counter to that. I think there is a serious case to be made that the next 4 years are going to be scarier than 2017 to 2021, for exactly the reasons you mentioned. Having said that, for me, I think my lack of emotional reaction to it, at least not to the extent that you had it, for example, is that we've kind of established who he is. We know who he is now. Whereas in 2016, for me, it was such a symbol about the decay of the world, right? Like, where is the world heading if the most important democracy on earth is willing to vote for this man? How is it possible that we're here? Now we know that we're here. We know not just in the United States, but also in European countries that we're sliding down this hill. And the Trump election is just another bad sign of that, and also another bad step in that wrong direction. So, yes, I agree with you that probably the presidency, especially domestically in the United States, is going to be more detrimental, more destructive in the next 4 years than it was during his first term. Absolutely. Having said that, we also kind of know what to prepare for. We know what to kind of expect. We know that this is already happening. It's not a surprise that voters are fed up with sort of the establishment, that voters do not want to hear about, you know, the middle of the road politics that the Democrats have been advocating for so long. And in that sense, it is a much less surprising result to me than it was in 2016.
Mm. One of the reasons why I did not want to talk about the election results at all, particularly Wednesday morning, is because I was dreading the type of basically newspaper articles or analysis pieces I would have to read all day long. Because for this, I have enough experience now in international relations and with elections, is that after an upset win like this, everyone sits down for 3 hours and writes, oh, how could this happen? Oh, the mistakes that were done here and what Trump did right and so on and so forth. And kind of just licking, right, kind of licking the wounds from last night and trying to cope with all of it. And I did not want to read any of these articles. I just said, no, it's a whole media blackout for me. I don't want to see anything. And so what did you do? You sent me a screenshot of the Guardian landing page. So I at first I thought, oh, to confirm all my expectations. And it was indeed, it was that bad, right? I mean, the screenshot basically shows 16 different articles, and all of them are about Trump and the election in some form. And also all of them very boring, like just very boring takes. Like every day, honestly, just use ChatGPT next time. Don't do it yourself. Like anyone could have written these articles.
First of all, you're very welcome, Dario, for me not respecting your emotional state of mind. And yes, of course, these inane articles are not a good read, and they are not particularly useful. I think in some ways, one of the most interesting reactions came actually from my dearly beloved Bernie Sanders, who wrote basically straight away, I'm pretty sure he had written it already before the elections, but he published it afterwards, a letter saying the Democratic Party needs to wake up and needs to deal with the real issues that are being that they are facing. And Democrats don't really seem to understand that. But most other articles and media reactions were about, hey, campaign mistakes, as if the campaign was the issue. In itself, the campaign was fine. It was just that there was not enough to run on. The content behind the campaign wasn't there. Harris was okay as a candidate. It wasn't great. She wasn't amazing, but she was fine. The problem is the underlying dynamics where people are getting completely fed up with that center, middle of the road politics that the Democrats have been so responsible for. And all the articles that The Guardian published were either about, oh, how sad this is for the Harris campaign and how sad, and let's say a warm farewell to beloved Joe Biden, or they were about we will now begin our fight. And that is, of course, incredibly bad. Anyone who is on the other side of the political spectrum to Trump needs to, first of all, now look at Trump and say, okay, what's going to happen? Let's analyze what he's going to do. What are his supporters expecting? That's an important question to ask. And secondly, sit in a corner, be quiet for a while and think about what you've been doing wrong. You know, be ashamed of yourself for a couple of months, go through some introspective process and come back with the right lessons learned from that.
Because they definitely did something wrong. I mean, Trump, right, because the first time Trump won the election was kind of this thing of, the Electoral College, that weird election system the United States has, the outdated thing, that's the only way he could win, let's be honest. Right, so that was kind of the mood in 2016. It wasn't so much about what mistakes did we maybe do, or people maybe fed up with the system. That came a few months afterwards, actually. And everyone basically hung on to this idea of, oh, we won the basically overall popular vote. And then in 2020, right, when you had that really, kind of also tight election at first between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, there Democrats really won the Electoral College, but also the popular vote, right? With like 81 million people voting for Joe Biden and 74 million people voting for Donald Trump. And now if you look at the results from this week, what really surprised me is that Trump actually lost a few hundred thousand votes, right? So only 73 million people, I think, voted for him. But Harris lost 12 million votes compared to Joe Biden. So that has to show you something, right? If you now look at these results, it's not, oh, was the campaign mistake? Oh, we weren't able to mobilize people and so on and so forth. Yeah, you weren't able to mobilize them because people are just really fed up with what has been happening. And for that, it's again, astonishing to me that the race beforehand was by the media and by everyone else kind of was depicted as, oh, this is going to be a really tight race.
Well, that last bit is a very clear indication of why we should always be so skeptical of opinion polls. I've seen too many elections where opinion polls were completely wrong. They were basically right 4 years ago, roughly. But opinion polls can be terribly wrong for loads of reasons, because you're dealing not with a hard science, you're dealing with the psychology of people. People have to answer your question if you're a pollster. And they might answer that question wrongly, they might change their mind, or they might be lying to you. Also, you might not reach the right people. So basically, there has been a certain arrogance among political scientists. There has been a certain arrogance about among opinion pollsters saying, we know exactly how to gauge the reality of our political environment. And the answer to that is, of course, you don't. Sometimes you get it right, sometimes you get it wrong, which means that we need to be skeptical. In this case, they got it horribly wrong. It was, for every opinion poll, it was obvious that the national vote was going to go to Harris. It very, very clearly didn't. And it was going to be super close for the Electoral College. It very much wasn't. You know, if Trump had won with a few Electoral College votes, then the opinion polls could have made a claim. Fine, we said it was close. But they said that it was a complete toss-up and Trump in the end won with an enormous margin. Now, with respect to the first bit, there have been reactions when someone like Bernie Sanders published what I just mentioned. Straight away there were reactions of, how can you say this? Joe Biden has been the most pro-working class candidate in our president in ages. He has done this and he's done that and he's done that. And that tells you everything you need to know about this establishment mindset. It tells you that they can no longer think outside of the box. For them, Joe Biden has been radical. Whereas for any outsider looking in, there has been nothing radical about the Biden presidency. Yes, he has tried a few things and some of these things worked. But you need to have a vision of where you want to take the country. You have to have a big idea of what is it, how are you going to solve the enormous problems related to poverty, relating to the shrinking middle class, relating to the fact that there is a top 1% of people who own 50% of the country's wealth. All those issues need to be dealt with in a big vision type of thinking. And that's no longer possible in the managerial world that Democrats and also establishment European political parties live in.
Absolutely. And here I want to go back to the screenshot we were talking about, because yes, the screenshot was basically disturbing my emotional peace on Wednesday morning. But it also, right, just being able to read the titles of these different articles, it was interesting what basically now the take would be of you know, I mean, the guardian of kind of that liberal establishment, right? It was a lot of, oh, how sad, Paris lost and there were some campaign mistakes. Oh, Joe Biden, the old man, we're really going to miss him. But then there was one article by the editor-in-chief of the Guardian that kind of caught our attention here, because it was basically an opinion piece and a call to action.
Straight away, right? So this is the morning after the elections. Not all votes are even in yet. And the article has the headline, "How the Guardian will stand up to 4 more years of Donald Trump." And as you said, this is the editor-in-chief, Catherine Viner, who basically immediately says, "We will now fight for the next 4 years against Trump." And when I read that, I wanted to basically shout at my screen, like, what is wrong with you? This is exactly what has been the problem for all of this time. Instead, what you should be doing is not fight Trump. We know that Trump is a racist. We know that he's a sexist. We know he's a problem. We know he's going to undermine the political system in the United States. We know that he might do something crazy or volatile on the global stage. That is a set established fact. The question is, how come that 75 million people were still willing to vote for the guy, and so many people, other people, weren't willing to vote for Harris? You need to stand up against the way that politics on the left has happened. You have to stand up against the opposition of Trump. You have to say, you have been failing. How can we do things better? How can we have a bigger vision? Don't fight Trump. Come up with a better idea that people will connect to. On top of that, you are the Guardian, you are a journalist. I want you to report reality. I want you to analyze reality. I don't want you to be Amnesty International, because we have an organization for that. It's called Amnesty International. So please, please do not feel that you, as the Guardian, as a journalist, need to take a militancy, a call to action stance. You need to analyze why the Democrats, why the establishment politicians are not reaching voters, and how we can create a new vision for a more hopeful world that people will relate to and will pull them away from Donald Trump.
I mean, exactly this type of behavior is the reason why people vote for Trump, right? It's kind of like, oh, well, I'm not going to have the liberal media from Europe tell me how to live my life here in the United States.
It is insanity. It is both from a journalistic perspective, don't be an activist, you're a journalist, and from a just analytical perspective, don't fight Trump, provide a new picture, provide a new vision. From both those perspectives, it's such a terrible, terrible take. But to be honest, it's very much in line with what The Guardian has become, and it is very much in line in general with this zeitgeist that we talked about, right? Because this goes kind of back to that emotional state of mind. It is a way for The Guardian to say, all right, this is a horrible moment. We feel emotionally scarred by Trump winning, but we're going to get a feel-good factor with the idea that we can now fight back. We are not victims. We're gonna oppose evil. That kind of comfort bubble that is being created is very much in line with the problems that currently are facing the world, namely that it's all about an emotional good versus evil situation rather than embracing the complexities of real life.
Mm. And basically, as a direct result of the US elections, of the outcome on Wednesday morning, then Wednesday evening, something good for me happened, because it distracted me from the US elections, but only in the short term good for me. because in the long term it's going to cause a bit of trouble here in Germany. And that is that the German government went bonkers. This is how I wrote it down here in our little planning document, and I think it's a very fitting description, because basically the German government imploded on Wednesday evening, right? So maybe we should provide a bit more context here for international listeners. There has been a coalition government in Germany for 3 years now, between the Social Democratic Party, between the Green Party and the Liberal Democratic Party. That is an unprecedented situation. Germany before has only had two-party coalition governments. Anything with more than two parties becomes very messy. I think I'm speaking to the right person about this, right? I think the Netherlands doesn't have very good experiences with these types of governments.
Well, the Netherlands has had always coalition governments, but of course lately it has not been working particularly well, even though the long tradition of Dutch politics is coalition governance, right?
Of course, same for the Germans, right? It's coalition governments. It makes sense, right? There's a lot of reasons for it. But as soon as you kind of move beyond a certain number, which for me is two, it becomes very messy, very difficult, because you kind of need to balance different interests, particularly with this party set up. So these three set parties, the Green Party and the Liberal Party are basically opposing each other directly. They stand for completely opposite way of lives. So that's the scene, right? And for, I would say, already a year now, there has been talk going on right here in political Berlin, where also the scene that I work in, there has been a lot of talk on, are we going to have early elections, which for Germans and the German political system, again, is not a normal thing. There's maybe a different political culture in other countries, but for Germans, you know, we vote once every 4 years, and anything in between is a state election or we don't want it. And so therefore it was a bit of a shock. And the reason kind of then why it imploded on Wednesday evening is basically the election of Donald Trump. Not a disagreement over Trump, but the realization that, okay, Donald Trump has said from day one that he's going to end the war in Ukraine. I mean, I really hope we get to do an episode about this in the next few weeks, because he said he would fix it or end it within the first 100 days. I'm very excited to see the results. But that the United States is basically wasting money supporting Ukraine, right? And so the German government said, oh no, the biggest donor of weapons, of aid in general to Ukraine is basically kind of like falling short. So now the second largest donor, which is Germany, has to step up. And that decision or that realization basically came into very intensive discussions over the budget for the next year, where the chancellor, who's from the Social Democratic Party, was butting heads with the leader of the Liberal Party, right? So this left side of the spectrum kind of going, yes, we'll support Ukraine, we just have to go into debt over this, or basically take on more debt for next year. And the leader of the Liberal Party said, no, I'm very much against this idea of overspending. We can't do this, right? Maybe a little side factor, right? This is actually part of the German constitution since the euro crisis, so since 2013, I believe, where it basically says that the German budget cannot be negative, right? We have existing debt from the past, but we don't want to take any new debt because we don't want our poor children to pay for it, which, hey, as a poor child, right, I very much welcome that in theory, right? So that's this, except in exceptional circumstances, right? Such as COVID, the war in Ukraine, and the resulting rise in energy prices, and kind of like an extra budget for the military that we've had in the past, right? So that's kind of setting off the scene. Did I forget anything?
No, I think that's about it.
Yeah, and I hope so. If I'm wrong, or if any of the German listeners want to correct us, please feel free to do so. And so, right, so you have this budget discussion, and now you have this discussion about additional billions of aid for Ukraine, which basically set the whole thing off because, the finance minister refused to basically kind of, right, declare an emergency of sorts, right, or exceptional circumstances and go into further debt for the budget next year. And the chancellor asked him to do so. And if you refuse to do what your boss tells you to do, well, then your boss gets to fire you. And that's then what happened. And then the Liberal Party basically withdrew from the coalition. And now the chancellor and the Green Party no longer have a majority to govern, which means that most likely, right, it's not final yet, but there will be a vote of confidence that the chancellor is most likely not going to survive, and then there will be new elections in March.
So the first thing about your statement of the Germany going bonkers, from a meta perspective, I think there the analysis is this is exactly the issue that we're facing worldwide. So not just in Germany, the world is. We have an understanding of reality about what the world is supposed to be, and currently the present and the future are taking us into a new reality where everything seems a little bit crazy. The fact that Trump gets elected is crazy compared to what we knew for the past 80 years or so, or 90 years. The fact that the German government is in this kind of chaos is crazy compared to how normally German politics is supposed to be run. And so there are these dynamics that we're not controlling that are creating a new reality in front of our eyes. And that is scary and that is problematic because predictability helps us plan ahead, helps us prepare. But if the future is not predictable, if the present isn't even predictable, then how are we gonna shape the world into a form that we feel comfortable with, right?
Absolutely. And particularly in a country such as Germany, right, where the political culture is so much focused on let's make the reasonable choice here, right? That amount of, or that element of unpredictability is really scary. And I think that's also one of the reasons why, right, there was talk of this happening, but no one actually thought this was a serious option because it is considered political suicide. Because one of the results of this, basically of the government no longer having a majority, is that they are most likely not going to be able to pass the budget for the next year. And so the budget will kind of be running on an emergency budget. But no big problems, right, can be tackled, right? So no investments into infrastructure, into the climate transition, into maybe revitalizing the economy, which that's actually the biggest topic for most Germans right now, right? It's that for 2 years now we've been in a recession and every political party talks about it. Oh, we need to get the German economy going again. We've kind of been having some internal troubles. Let's analyze and try to figure out what's happening, right? And that would be the reasonable choice as to let's pass a budget for this and maybe have, new elections were going to happen anyways in September of next year. So let's do the reasonable thing. But no, they did not. And one of the things, one of the factors, if you ask me, kind of explaining this is, surprise, surprise, hello, here's the Western Bubble podcast, is actually the Western Bubble, right? Because the original reason for this was we need additional billions for Ukraine. And now my question then is to the government, oh, why do we need additional billions? Like, what do we need this for? And then the answer will be, well, you know, and this has actually been the narrative right now, we are nearing 1,000 days of conflict in Ukraine, right? 1,000 days since Putin has aggressively and unprovoked and intentionally and all of these things invaded Ukraine. Yeah, factually true. And we basically need to support Ukraine because the United States will no longer do it. And otherwise, if we don't do that, right, your typical horror scenarios. Oh, that's the end of democracy. That will be the end of the West. Tomorrow, Putin will be in Berlin and so on and so forth, right? So kind of this thinking within the Western bubble that Ukraine needs to win no matter what. Otherwise, we will all be done. That has now led to this government basically defaulting on itself, on just its own ideology.
Yeah, so that last bit of the government defaulting, what you're describing is exactly the problem that I mentioned before. Namely, we live in an era of uncertainty, of chaos, of not knowing what's going to happen next. And the vicious circle that we're in is that chaos leads to behavior that makes it impossible to deal with the chaos. So it basically, the chaos and the uncertainty that we live in leads to the government falling, which means that we now don't have the tools available to actually deal with the uncertainty that caused it in the first place, right? So that's why it is not, I don't think, panic thinking to say that there is something deeply, deeply scary about the world that we are facing right now, because we don't have the tools anymore to make the world into the shape that we want it to be. With respect to the Ukraine thing, yeah, this exactly fits into that pattern, because it directly connects to Catherine Viner of The Guardian saying, we will fight Trump. We live in this world where people are looking for emotional comfort because they feel fearful and scared. And if you look for emotional comfort, you want to go to places where you can say, I'm fighting the good fight versus evil. That is The Guardian fighting Trump for the next 4 years, despite it being completely counterproductive. And it is Germany, or at least Scholz, and the Green Party fighting evil Putin, despite it probably being completely counterproductive, in the sense of, we need to pump more money into Ukraine, it makes us feel good about ourselves, we are the knights in shiny armor defending the poor Ukrainian democracy against the evil authoritarian orcs from Moscow, and it creates a bubble of comfort where I don't have to think about the complexity of life in terms of Ukraine. I don't have to think about what success looks like. I don't have to think about what will be some realistic outcome of this conflict. What will be a way forward that we can stop having soldiers die on the battlefield? Those questions are too difficult. They are too scary. Let's not deal with that. I'm going to just create a black and white world where I'm the good guy fighting the bad guy.
Because we've discussed exactly this in the past, that there were exit points in the Ukraine conflict over the last 2.5, almost 3 years, 1,000 days. There were multiple times when negotiations were a real option. There could have been a peaceful, at least, I don't want to say end, but at least a halt, right, to the conflict and to the fighting and to the humanitarian suffering, right? That's always what we're talking about, is Ukrainian soldiers dying, Russian soldiers dying, Ukrainian civilians suffering, civilian infrastructure being destroyed, the whole country being destroyed, and basically all the billions that you're sending all the time, right? So you basically, oh, let's build up this bridge. Ah, the bridge has been destroyed. Oh, let's spend this money on a tank. Ah, the tank has been destroyed. Right? Yeah, those are material things, and on the side, and always people die, and we're just prolonging this conflict without actually reaching our goals. And to draw a comparison or basically similarities to the election in the United States, because we will be having elections in a few months. In the US, people were really fed up with, right, kind of demons being battled that had nothing to do with the everyday life of the voters. And this is already the existing reality in Germany, that more and more people are becoming fed up with, oh, you're sending billions to Ukraine, but isn't our economy struggling, right? Like, shouldn't we invest this money here at home, right, to maybe solve the problems that are actually making my life miserable right now? I mean, people are, again, because we are in a recession and companies are starting to lay off people, you now have a lot of workers who are sitting at home and saying, ah, okay, haha, my government would rather fight demons in Ukraine than, I don't know, support the local economy at home and save my job. I mean, it sounds really cynical, and it might not be, right, an accurate representation of the complexities of the world we're living in, but the wake up call, the average voter does not deal with the complexities of the world when they make the decision, as we just saw in the United States.
Yeah, so there's these two groups that are suffering because of this black and white thinking. It's the Ukrainians who are suffering because NATO is continuously fueling the conflict rather than actually being a productive way out. Because what you mentioned, those exit points, in multiple occasions, both the Zelensky government and the Putin government were willing to talk. And it was NATO countries who told Zelensky, don't do it, right? And then you've got the electorate at home in Germany or in the United States or elsewhere that think they just don't understand it. And rightfully so, they don't understand why we are all the time talking about Ukraine, why we're talking about foreign policy that is clearly not working, that is clearly failing, while they see their jobs disappear, while they see their infrastructure. Now, in terms of direct correlation, voters basically make a bridge, a link between those two that probably doesn't exist, right? So theoretically, you could continue fueling the war in Ukraine while also dealing with problems at home. But emotionally, that is a very difficult narrative to explain. And on top of that, there's just no reason for the United States or Germany to do what they're doing with Ukraine. It is counterproductive. It kind of reminds me what you just mentioned about Scholz and that, like, hey, we have to pump more money into the conflict. It's been going on for 1,000 years. In 2007, and I apologize for a bit of a history lesson here, but in 2007, the Iraq war wasn't going particularly well. The invasion of 2003, okay, it got rid of Saddam Hussein, but then violence broke out everywhere, the start of ISIS, etc., etc. And then the George W. Bush administration basically argued exactly this. We now need a surge, what they called it. A surge, we need to pump more money into the conflict to end it. And interestingly enough, it didn't work. But when the Obama administration came to power, they started pretending that it did work. Because from their perspective, they couldn't just pull out a failure, right? So they couldn't say, this has been a disaster. We are going to now just withdraw from Iraq because it hasn't done what it was supposed to do. Or we're going to withdraw from Afghanistan. Because as a government, you don't want to be on the losing side of what you have portrayed as a moral fight of righteousness, a righteous fight of good versus evil. So even though Obama, the candidate, was very critical of the surge, like, why would we pump more money into Iraq? The moment he got into government, he started embracing that and he started continuing exactly the violence for the same reasons. And so this is what you see with the Scholz government and certainly the Green Party in Germany, that they cannot be seen to have lost a conflict that they themselves overly simplistically portrayed as good versus evil. Because if they now withdraw from Ukraine, if they try to bring Zelensky and Putin to the negotiating table, they will have been responsible for failing righteousness, right? And that's a real emotional problem that they face and that society in general faces with these things.
Absolutely. And it doesn't, right? If we were living maybe in a world, I don't know, 30 something years ago, where populism to the extent we see it nowadays maybe wasn't such a strong factor in politics, that might be possible, right? Kind of saying, oh, yeah, you know what, sorry about this. The last 2.5 years weren't all that good and successful and it really didn't change much. Okay, let's say we'll go to the, okay, we'll push them to the negotiation table. Sorry. Yeah, but I mean, the narrative, right, that I kind of just explained, or like that feeling that people might have at home, is exactly the narrative being spun by left and right wing populists, kind of saying, you are not spending money at home, and therefore, like, because you're spending it on Ukraine, and therefore you're failing us at home, right? That's like, we're living in a world where it's also, right, kind of talking about the topic of the episode here, emotional comfort, where it's simply not comfortable enough because of your surroundings and your context to kind of really admit that you made a mistake here. And with certain politicians, I honestly lost the belief that they would be even able to admit that they are wrong because they're so caught up in this narrative, in this Western bubble, saying that if Ukraine fails, the West fails and democracy dies.
Which is, once again, that good versus evil thing that is so powerful in today's world. The world, in reality, here's the reality, as Balder sees it. The world is incredibly complex. There are constructive forces, constructive dynamics and destructive forces, but it hardly ever happens that there's an absolute right and an absolute wrong. There might be a few cases in history that we can obviously point at, the obvious moments. But that doesn't happen very often, certainly not in the complexity and the anarchy of the 21st century. But what happens is that people pretend that there's an absolute right and an absolute wrong, and it puts them into that emotional bubble that they will never escape from anymore. Because if it's about absolute right and absolute wrong, then you will never be able to reach out to the other side, because you don't negotiate with the other side. You don't actually try to understand the other side. You want to eradicate the other side. And this is, I think, one of the explanations as well why so many people like you and students around me, but also your absolutely right colleagues of my age, said on Wednesday, I don't want to talk about it, I don't want to think about it. I don't want to analyze what Trump is going to do. I don't want to understand what happened, because evil has won yesterday. And that overly simplistic picture makes the destructive forces in the world become stronger and stronger. And that makes it less and less likely that we'll be able to shape the world into an image that we feel comfortable with in reality rather than in our bubble.
So obviously we also talked about this topic at RAIA, right? The think tank that I'm a part of. And unfortunately there, I'm the boulder in that world where somehow they expect me to come up with wise things to say at the end of the podcast, you know, where it kind of makes everyone feel good about themselves. You know, first we analyze the world for 40 minutes and we talk about how terrible it is. And then we kind of, there's a half call for action, half here. If you just do this, right, let's not be so negative. Let's, you know, really analyze the problems. Let's solve these problems. You know, then you will feel better about ourselves. Yeah, right. That's our listeners notice. That's usually how these episodes go. And so I was in the situation with people at RAIA, right, and they're even younger than me. And it was exactly this, right? Of, oh, are we going to write about this now? Are we going to kind of point out how bad Trump is? And then I got to say, well, we can factually write about him, and we can, according to our methodology, say whether he is currently succeeding according to himself, right, or not. But we can't fall into this form of activism of what The Guardian is doing, right, of basically saying, oh, this is how RAIA is going to stand up to Donald Trump in the next 4 years. And the main reason I kind of pointed out for this is that we are too young, and it's your generation, Balder. You're the ones who would need to explain, understand the world right now, and kind of make sure that whatever is happening is maybe like not as damaging as it could be. And then it's here, us, the younger generation, the ones who were too scared to talk about this or to even listen about it or engage with the election, that we're the ones who really need to pay attention now and kind of make sure that we don't do the same mistakes in 20 years.
Yeah, I would argue that my generation also shouldn't be fighting Trump, as I've just argued before, right? It's not about fighting Trump. It's about realizing why Trump gets so many votes. Nobody needs to convince me that Trump shouldn't be in the White House. Sure, but he is. So let's understand that. And let's see what that means. Where does this come from? What does that mean for our future policymaking? What does that mean for the way that the Democratic Party and other parties around the world need to readjust their behavior and stop being so managerial about it and actually provide a hopeful, real vision? I'm not talking about hope in the Obama sense of marketing propaganda, like, hey, yes, we can. I'm talking about a real vision of this is the world in 20, 30 years time that we want to live in. And how are we going to get there? How are we going to approach that? What needs to happen to achieve that? And the answers to those questions would be relatively radical. But don't be afraid of radical answers. Radical doesn't necessarily mean bad. It means changing some foundations about that we have overly relied on for too long. And I wish that conversation were to take place rather than that we're heading for 4 years of just ranting about Trump. Because if you accept what I said before, that the world is generally complex and it's hardly ever a case of absolute good versus absolute evil, if you accept that position, then that means that you need to be a little bit friendly to each other. Even those people who like Trump, even those people who you think are racist, or those people you think are sexist, or those people you think are destructive. Unless you're dealing with absolute psychopaths, every human being requires a certain understanding and analysis and openness to have that conversation with them, right? And I think we somehow forgot that we live in a society, and living in a society means that we need to have a certain friendly attitude towards each other and accept that we can have big, big conversations about a world that we want to create, about the future we want to go into, but we can't afford to fight against imaginary evil Tolkienian hordes that are out to get us, because first of all, they don't exist. And secondly, that bubble is only counterproductive.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on emotional comfort or discomfort, right? Looking at the election in the United States and the return of Donald Trump and the German government going bonkers over it. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com and we'll try to incorporate them into our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
I chose a bit of a controversial author, in fact, a very controversial author, and I guess that fits nicely into what we just talked about, namely that it's not about absolute good versus absolute evil that we should be interested in, and we certainly shouldn't fall into the cancel culture trap. If you were to take any author from, let's say, the 19th century or before, they will be inherently racist, they will be inherently sexist, and that doesn't mean that we have to completely ignore them. In this case, I chose probably the most famous poem in the English language by Rudyard Kipling called If. And Rudyard Kipling was, from today's standards, an absolutely horrible neo-colonial or colonialist, because at that time the British Empire still existed. He was a horrible racist. I would encourage everyone to just, if they haven't yet, read The White Man's Burden to understand the deep, deep destructive racism that existed in the British Empire when it came to, for example, sub-Saharan Africa. So this was not a guy who in today's world would be politically in any way acceptable. But I think that the poem If fits into what we just talked about. And here's an abbreviated version. If you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two imposters just the same, if you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to broken and stoop and build them up with worn out tools, if you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue or walk with kings nor lose the common touch, if neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you, but none too much, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it. And, which is more, you'll be a man, my son.